Hey, this is Mike from the High Hash Rate Podcast. Before we get started, I just want to do a brief shout out to a partnership of ours, the Freedom Festival 2024 in the heart of New England on May 4th. Participate in a unique celebration where the pursuit of freedom, health, and community values come together through engaging activities and inspiring experiences. Immerse yourself in all things Bitcoin. That's right, including Bitcoin speakers, Bitcoin music, Texas Slim's Cattleman's Feast Barbecue, Bitcoin workshops, and etc. Participate in interactive demonstrations like parkour, cold plunge, wow, that sounds fun, hot tub, a soccer contest, and a raffle with prizes. Buy your tickets today. You can enter our affiliate link, HighRate20, for a 20% discount. You could also visit, for more information, massadoption.net. Anyway, on to our show.
Screw it. Here we go.
It was the back end of the Elon Musk saga. So he talked it up on the front end, and then on the back end, he shat on the energy usage. And she just randomly throws up this idea of just like, well, why don't we just do it with nuclear power if we're building SMRs and whatnot? And I just kind of got obsessed with it. It just like this, the idea just kept branching out into different ways that it can expand and benefit the industry and benefit the people that this electricity is going to touch. Like, we've already got plans to deploy the electricity. I am quite confident that applying something like Bitcoin mining to it will significantly amplify it.
Hey, everybody. This is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps.
Welcome back to High Hash Rate. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the introduction. Welcome back to High Hash Rate. Before we get into it, I want to take a second to talk about the fact bull market is back and starting to feel like it's, just getting started and starting to, I think it caught us by surprise. And I was going down the rabbit hole during the bull market in 2020, and I was so focused on how much fucking money I was making that I made every mistake someone can make when it comes to Bitcoin. I bought from Coinbase. I didn't practice self-custody. Then when I did take self-custody, I bought a ledger. But I learned from my mistakes and I fixed them. And I'm telling you from experience that if you don't already custody your own keys in cold storage, if you picked a hardware wallet a long time ago, now you kind of regret it. Or if you just aren't confident you set your wallet up correctly back when you got it. Or maybe you could just benefit from starting over and making sure you do everything the right way this time. You owe it to yourself and your family to do it and to do that soon so you can safely navigate the next wave of adoption. But most importantly, you need to do your own research and you need to do what's best for you and your family. But while you're doing that, research the BitBox O2 hardware wallet. It's a secure, open source, Bitcoin-only hardware wallet, which can be paired with other open source wallets like Electrum, Spectre, Sparrow. It could be used with a multisig. It's a physical device that even looks inconspicuous. Like, people won't know that's a hardware wallet. And in my opinion, the design of the device coupled with the BitBox app make BitBox O2's user experience the best in Bitcoin. So if you do decide to buy a BitBox O2, you can use the link in the show notes and you can get 5% off your purchase. And BitBox has great customer support. And as some of you already know, if you DM me on Twitter or Nostr, I'm always available to answer your questions about self-custody and UTXO management. We're here with Nuclear Bitcoiner. And I've been so excited about this episode. I think we've mentioned it a few times, maybe briefly, but I don't think it comes up honestly on here very often. But like my other rabbit hole that I'm deep down, and I have been for a few years now, is uranium and nuclear energy. And so now we have Nuclear Bitcoin around here. So enough from me. Bro, how you doing? What's going on? What are you up to these days?
Hey, Mike. Dan, thanks for having me. I'm just trying to push a simple idea of trying to mine Bitcoin with nuclear power into the discussion that's happening right now with this energize everything environment that we find ourselves in, where there's a lot of push for preferred technologies by varying parties, and it feels like everyone's fighting for seat at the subsidy trough, and it can get pretty dicey out there at times with the arguments between advocates of between the nuclear and the hydrocarbons and wind and solar and what's going to be the best path forward for humanity. And I'm a firm believer that nuclear power is going to play a significant role in the future of humanity's energy needs, especially considering the rate at which we are growing. And I find it funny that a lot of the argument settles around that it takes a long time to build, as if we're not going to still need a significant amount of power 20, 40, 50 century from now, which like these nuclear reactors are going to be like multi-generational assets that are going to be serving our society for a very long time. Like take Canada's nuclear fleet, for example. Like they were built in the 70s and 80s, and now they're getting a complete refurbishment overhaul and extending their life well into the 2060s. So Canada's, or at least Ontario, is going to have nuclear power for a very, very long time. And it's looks like we're going to also be expanding it and hopefully getting back into the export markets that we haven't been serving for at least 20 years or so. Yeah. So,
okay. So when I saw your episode on Why Bitcoin with Sly Goomba, who is, I've been on his show a few times. He's been on this show a few times. One of our favorite guests. One of the things I tweeted like that night was, someday nuclear Bitcoiner is going to be a job, kind of like longshoreman or like, you know, fireman, things like that. Like it's going to be common. But like the thing about, well, I want to refer people to your episode on Why Bitcoin, because I think you guys really covered the fundamentals and the basics of nuclear energy, uranium, how Bitcoin can, they can have this synergy and they can work together. And if you don't really have a background in nuclear energy or uranium, you should definitely check that out first, that episode first. But one of the things similar to Bitcoin is you can't grok it like your first touch with it, your first day. Like it takes time. It's very, in some ways, very complex, very complicated. Nuclear energy is kind of similar. I think to really appreciate it, you really have to take time to understand it, to research it, and to learn about it. And you seem to know quite a bit about this. You seem to have a lot of knowledge on this relatively obscure or like complicated topic. So I'm wondering what your background is. How did you get to this point where did you work in the nuclear industry? Do you study nuclear energy or nuclear engineering in college? Like how'd you get here?
I actually ended up in the nuclear sector in Canada in a bit of a roundabout way. I'm educated as a chemical technologist. So I had worked a few jobs in my first 10 years in the private sector as a chemical technologist at refineries, at a steel mill, just running various instrumentation to analyze the elemental composition of various materials and whatnot. And then after one of my brief layoffs, I had managed to score a lab position at Canadian Nuclear Laboratories, where I currently now reside. And I've been overseeing the operations of a laboratory that it analyzes material that comes from the pressure tubes of the CANDU reactor fleet, and we measure the amount of hydrogen and deuterium that ingresses into them from the heavy water that is used in our CANDU fleet, as that is one of the unique features of them that allows it to use natural uranium instead of enriched uranium. But we monitor the corrosion in those pressure tubes, and when they reach a certain threshold, then the utilities will determine that it's time to replace that tubing, and they will either replace single tubes that have exceeded the like certain limitations, or if it's a full systemic reasons, they will go for full refurbishment, like is what is happening right now for the entire Ontario fleet. So it's
what is the nuclear energy industry like in general in Canada, right? So I know that Germany kind of committed seppuku and decided to shut all their nuclear fleet down, and now their energy prices are through the roof and they're dependent on Russian oil and coal from Poland and things like that. And the United States has not been investing in its nuclear energy. It has been growing in places like China, Japan, South Korea, even the Middle East. What about Canada? I don't hear much about Canada. It seems like they have so much oil and gas that it's maybe a second afterthought there.
Yeah, like Canada is definitely well known for our gas and oil. Alberta is very world renowned for the oil sands and the resources that they export from there. But Canada has historically been one of the tier one nuclear nations that's up there. But I do recognize what you're saying. Like a lot of the times when there's talk about nuclear power, it's Japan, it's Russia, it's China, it's France. There's the Nordic countries. There's what Germany's doing. But there's often little attention paid to what's going on in Canada. And like we kind of ebb and flow, and like there was a lot more interest and development in the sector here when we were building CANDU reactors and exporting them internationally. I think the last one that was completed was Cernavoda 1 and 2 in Romania in the early 2000s. And there was a Chinese CANDU reactor around the same time. But now there's two more reactors being completed at the Cernavoda site that is now being financed that had been left unfinished, that they didn't have the finances to complete 20 years ago. Canada is talking about expanding our fleet by expanding our largest reactor at the Bruce site to add another four reactors comprising about 5 gigawatts. We're planning on using a site that was already prepared for a large reactor at Darlington. We're going to use that for piloting some SMRs that a lot of markets are very interested in because they're 300 megawatts. So it applies in a good spot that's not serving like super large markets, but it's still big enough that they can get the economies of scale. And it's using familiar boiled water, pressurized water reactor technology that most of the fleets are already comprised of. So that the technological familiarity will help it reach maturity a lot faster. And there's a lot of interest from like the Tennessee Valley Authority. Poland has shown a lot of interest in getting these reactors. There's several other Eastern European countries want these reactors. And then there's stuff going on in New Brunswick right now. Like they have had a CANDU reactor for at least since the 80s or so. It was one of the first reactors to be refurbished. So it provided a lot of lessons that are being applied to making this current set of refurbishments go a lot more efficiently and cost effectively. But out in New Brunswick, they're also planning on building a molten salt reactor that will be able to be fueled with recycled fuel from other reactors. So like there's a lot of activity going on in research in the next generation and also sustaining our existing operating fleet.
Can I just hop in with a question there? It's a very stupid question, but I'm sure you could probably answer it. What can you just tell me, like, outline the benefit of nuclear over other
my question was built on kind of that premise, Mike. So my question was, we talk about how much oil and gas there is in Canada and how that's like kind of a major industry there. But Canada is also the second biggest producer of uranium, the nuclear fuel in most reactors in the world, right? Like Cameco Mines is up there. It's like the number one, it's been one of the hottest stocks on the market the past few years. But there's a lot of political and regulatory constraints for the nuclear energy because of all the energy sources that we use, like the nuclear energy, uranium is the most energy dense. We can power the most amount of, industries, cities, countries, whatever, with the fewest amount of units of uranium compared to just about anything else. It's also produces zero greenhouse gas emissions. So why is this not the main energy industry across the world? Why is it kind of relegated to the margins in most places?
There's been billions and billions and billions of dollars spent spreading FUD and fear about this technology.
Like, probably the biggest FUD of anybody's ever faced. Club,
like, they revel in spreading disinformation and exaggerating trivial safety concerns to make them sound more egregious than they actually are. Like, radiation is an industrial hazard that it poses a hazard, but it's a manageable hazard. We can measure it, we can detect it, we can shield ourselves from it, we can work with it, we can manage the waste safely. But they've had a strategy of creating like kind of self-fulfilling ideas where they will complain about a safety issue and then they will get like kind of like idea laundering, if you're familiar with that concept. You just like just put the idea out there and then the media picks it up and then they spread it and then more institutions spread it and then it gets into policy and then it costs a lot more to build a nuclear reactor. Some of it is definitely coming from competitive in the hydrocarbon industries. Then there's probably a lot coming from the advocates of like wind and solar, and it's there's an environmental zealotry that has an aversion to nuclear power. It's very strange for someone to call themselves an environmentalist but oppose this technology, unless there's some something driving them beyond just the merits of the technology.
And now that's what I kind of goes back to my question. Is nuclear power better than for generating power than other, these other source clean, you know, quote unquote sources that are coming up, or natural coal, or, and why is it?
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah. Well, first of all, clean is a relative term, because when you take the full scope of these supply chains, things can get pretty dirty pretty quickly. Like, if you only examine the operational aspect of a lot of these technologies, yeah, they can appear to be clean up on the surface. But when you start doing a lot more digging, you can see that there's a lot more than meets the
eye. The materials that they're made with, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, the rare materials that need to be extracted, the amount of mining that's required, like the magnets that are needed for these things. And these, like, windmills still need like lubrication and whatnot, and they need power to actually start them up sometimes. So, and like the subsidies.
Crazy. The subsidies, but also the what's not talked about enough is the amount of energy that goes into everything you just mentioned, all the mining, all of the purification, all of the processing to create these solar panels or to create these windmills versus the amount of energy that you get out of them. So it's like, if you're putting more energy into something.
Energy returned on energy invested. Right. That's, yeah.
And what's the return on invested capital for energy from like a nuclear reactor compared to, you know, a windmill?
Like, what's the scale? Like, what could it serve?
A gigawatt serves a good like million plus city plus amazing. Pretty wow. heavy industry. Like the fleet in Ontario, I think altogether
there's
10
so
gigawatt.
Many cities there's so many cities out there with like minus a million people. You just plop a power plant in each one of these places and you'll have like
you could do small modular reactors for towns and cities.
Yeah, because that's been one of the biggest problems is you can't, yeah, it has to be appropriate for the market that it's being deployed into. So if you don't have customers for the full capacity that you're building, then you end up leaving that stranded, and then that has its own economic risks. And like, they're building a lot of this new advanced reactors to be capable of load following a lot more effectively than the traditional fleet, which can, but there's rate limits and time limits on how long you can do it before it starts to have negative consequences. But there's always going to be an economic opportunity cost that has to be considered if you're curtailing your load or diverting it to some other type of load where that you can monetize it. So it has been tricky to navigate. And now that there's a lot more intermittent generators coming onto the market, and they have been getting better policy in the way that they sell their power into these grids combined with like the subsidies, it does create an unfair advantage in the power markets against generators that only make money by selling power. So they are a lot more affected by the market being out of whack.
Right. What one of my, maybe you don't know the answer to this, maybe we can look it up, but roughly how much uranium would it take to run a gigawatt reactor for 1 year?
It's like a setup for a joke.
Yeah,
no,
I don't
it's
know.
I
know.
I've heard the number, like it's been talked about on Decoupled all the time. They get into numbers like that, but I know I don't have my fuel pellets with me, but I had a little fuel pellet. It's about yay big, just a little cylinder. That is roughly the equivalent of one person's energy usage for an entire year. It's like a kilogram.
That's
thousands
kind of what
of barrels of oil and thousands of kilograms of coal.
But
okay, yeah. So thousands, it's this little thousands of pellet, basically.
Yeah, it comes in these rods too.
Oh, I think my wife just ran off. She's going to go get some from the printer.
You can concentrate a person's entire energy use for their entire year into a pellet
BB,
into a BB. Yeah.
That's energy density, baby.
Yeah, this can's probably about a lifetime. If that volume of uranium, so that's why it's also like the waste. It's such a trivial thing because the volume of it is so minuscule that we can manage it. Like, I talk now about using horizontal drilling as a means to
create deep geological repositories for the waste that we can't get any more valuable utility out of. So that plus like the DGRs, the nearest surface disposal facilities, like we've got options for the waste. We just need to get the political will to back it. And
like, yeah, that's, just, well, you're, that's it, my,
it's like fighting it. I mean, it's very obvious why you'd be fighting that. Those industries would be fighting that.
Well, yeah, it creates a chicken and an egg thing because they'll be like, oh, we shouldn't be building more nuclear power until we are able to manage the waste. But managing the waste is roadblocked at every step of the way. So it's they're creating the problems that they like to complain about. It's one of the most frustrating things with advocating for this industry is dealing with just this. It's such a disingenuous way that the anti-advocates argue against the technology.
Right.
But I've got my pellet now. Yeah. It's about that big.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Wow.
Your whole life energy. How much does that probably cost if it was...
And can you burn that energy and turn it into Bitcoin?
Well, yeah.
Absolutely.
We definitely have to get into that, of course.
Yeah. So my next question was, and you've already talked about this, the FUD. We talk about, you know, in Bitcoin, we're constantly complaining about the media FUD. And most of it's like hilariously bad. It's not even good media FUD. But there's no industry, there's no material, there's no asset, there's no energy source and in the world history probably that has faced as much FUD and as much like effective, scary FUD as nuclear energy and as uranium, as you know, as this industry. And it's like part of it's this deep, deep generational trauma that people have from the atom bombs and stuff in World War II, and then this the Cold War and the nuclear hysteria and Chernobyl and all these scary things. They sound super scary, and people think of like a nuclear meltdown or an issue at a nuclear energy facility, a reactor, and they associate that with nuclear war and like fallout and things like that. So as a result, you can build these reactors, right, that can serve a million people. But if you don't necessarily have a million people, you need to like slowly build up a customer base or industrialize. It's very difficult to do, right? Because all this FUD has created all of this regulatory roadblock, all of this red tape, all this lobbying, all this FUD, so that if you were to open a nuclear energy reactor plant, energy plant, whatever, anywhere, you have all this energy, but your costs to run that facility are, it's just got to be untenable, right? Like it's so much regulatory compliance and just having to do updates and maintenance. And it's not like standards are bad, right? But like this is the one industry where you can really point to and be like, this is egregious.
Yeah, it definitely is disproportionately affected more than other industries, but like relative to the upfront capital required to build these things and then like the ticking clock of interest on that capital, the operational cost of a nuclear reactor is like insignificant. Like the fuel costs and operating costs are peanuts. Like they say like when we're doing our analysis, it's part of the CANDU's like regular maintenance schedule, and they always stress like every hour that they are not operating, like they're losing potentially $1 million in revenue. So like they take this shit seriously, and like the professionals in this industry take this seriously. Like they're not suicidal, like they know how to operate these machines. Like Chernobyl was just a terrible design, operated terribly in a terrible political managerial environment. And what a lot of people aren't even aware of is that there was other reactors on that site that continued operating for well over a decade after that event had happened. They just entombed it and they kept on operating. They shielded the worst of it, and they haven't really had, like, there's not any noticeable uptick in radiation caused illnesses in the area. And it's actually now like a pristine nature reserve. Like it's crazy that like the events going on in Ukraine right now around like the Zaporizhzhia reactor, and the way that it lost its cooling when that hydro dam got blown out, and it lost the reservoir that cooled it. So that was an interesting
situation, just seeing how that reactor was capable of being shut down into a safe state long before the cooling was an issue. So like, that's what happened to Fukushima. They weren't able to get it into that safe state while they were still had active cooling. So
yeah.
And so now they've learned that lesson and they've applied that in a big way.
Yeah. I saw a stat the other day, and then maybe somebody can verify this, but it said that in everything included, all the meltdowns, you know, every incident that's happened at the nuclear plant, the amount of casualties per capita is the lowest in nuclear energy than any other, including solar, wind, coal, all those. Like, they have more fatalities per capita than nuclear does, even accounting for the biggest incidences.
Yeah, they were definitely sensationalized because of people's relationship with radiation. And you get it because of their exposure to the Cold War and that hyped up scenario that they lived through. And then, like, Simpsons didn't do any justice for our generation.
That's what I was going to say. Like, where do all of us millennials get our information about nuclear? The fucking Simpsons. that's what we know about it.
Yeah, so like, people have these preconceived notions, then they're like, it's hard to unwedge those. It's much easier to teach somebody that knows nothing about the industry about it and like let them make their own ideas. But unlodging ideas that are already deeply embedded is much more challenging in the education and advocacy process. So it's
right.
Some people have just made up their minds.
And it's hard to compete with competing energy industries that are just constantly subsidized despite their lack of efficiency as well. But there is light at the end of the tunnel, right? Because we're starting to realize that there is a new consumer or customer of last resort that is insatiable when it comes to consuming energy and will consume as much cheap energy as you can feed it. That's a Bitcoin network. And I think there's been a few examples in like Georgia and Ohio and Pennsylvania of Bitcoin miners kind of working with the utilities companies and the nuclear reactor companies, and they're buying their energy with Bitcoin mining in on sites nearby. What do you know about that? Like, have you been working with that? Is that something you're advocating for, I assume, right?
Yeah, I'm definitely advocating for more of that. There was, when I started on Twitter, there was very little of that. That's kind of what birthed the nuclear Bitcoiner NIM. Was just anytime I heard nuclear power coming up in the Bitcoin space, it was always sad stories about reactors being shut down all over the America. Like, I list off like Pilgrim, Palisades, Vermont Yankee.
Bear market for nuclear energy.
Terrible. But then in recent years, the bleeding got stemmed, and the advocates planted their flag at Diablo Canyon, and they reversed that. There was another one, I think Dresden or Byron in Illinois was stopped from being shut down as well. And now there's active efforts to get Palisades back operational. The Indian Point was like absurd that they shut that one down. But now what's noticeably happening is the Quebec pie is getting sliced a lot thinner because of all of these, like the Northeast Corridor that shut down several of their large baseload capacity. They're importing more. And recently it was Massachusetts wanted to also get in on the importing power from Quebec game, but the transmission lines that they needed to build were blocked by the states that it would have to be built through. And obviously, like, they're probably thinking like, there's only so much of this pie to go around, because even Quebec in the winter, they spread themselves pretty thin because they're almost entirely electrical heating. And I actually had a conversation with someone recently that the Quebec has a demand response program similar to ERCOT's. It doesn't get advertised as much as the ones that we hear about down in Texas. But the Bitcoin miners in Quebec are like 95% of that market. And the other 5% is like a bit of industry and a few aggregated loads from just like residential electrical heating and commercial loads, stuff like that. So that was very interesting to see that going that way. And then, like you had mentioned, like the Pennsylvania, that's the Talen Energy thing, and we just saw that
Amazon Web Services just bought up a high performance data center that was being built on that site, which I think that was the strategy all along between Talon and TerraWulf, that they were going to build a Bitcoin mining site and have a little bit of a campus for that. And then with a completely different load profile and electricity needs, build like a big high performance computing center, which clearly that strategy has paid off and they've gotten interest from some big players in the data industry. And I foresee this becoming a trend, especially for large baseload generators that haven't been able to sell their power completely to the market. And when they get exposed to negative prices, they either get forced to curtail or eat up that paying someone else to take their electricity. Like when our fleet in Ontario was running at full capacity, when we don't have two reactors down for refurbishments, we can curtail as much as 20 terawatt hours a year, curtail or negatively price, which basically means we're paying the northern states to take our electricity. And then it creates this feedback loop where then they start to rely on it too much. And then when it starts to dry up and we want it for ourselves, then they get left in a shitty situation. And right. Then they expand their natural gas and their coal burning because they shut down their reliable power.
Right. Right. Did that? I think there was a similar situation last year in Europe, right? Like the French were exporting all this nuclear energy. Some of these surrounding countries were growing dependent on it, kind of being lazy themselves in terms of innovation and self-sufficiency in energy. And then, you know, the rivers dried up in France in the summertime and they had to shut down the plants because they didn't have water to cool their reactors and they weren't able to service all these customers. And so you had, like, you start getting into these moments where Germans and others are like burning wood pellets, which is even worse for the environment.
Imported
from
North Carolina.
Yeah.
Right.
That's so bizarre.
And that's considered a green energy. Like, who is it defining this stuff?
And but I think maybe to go back a little bit and summarize kind of where the situation with maybe the climate around nuclear energy globally and politically is, we talked about this like bear market in nuclear energy that probably the deepest low, maybe you can tell me if you agree with this, was back the earthquake in Japan and Fukushima and the issues with that plant. And so
it's stymied a lot of momentum.
Right. It wasn't as bad as Chernobyl. It wasn't as sensational as Chernobyl, but it was close. And like the world was kind of like, oh,
definitely
shit.
Hyped
like,
up as if it was.
Right. And so Germany started shutting everything down. Japan, of course, shut everything down. But as things have started to turn around, I would say like the glimmer of hope that people's minds are changing is that Japan is now turning their reactors back on. Germany is even capitulating and like extending some of the life of potentially opening. They have, like, Germany has some of the most high-tech, newest, state-of-the-art reactors, and they shut them down. And they're even talking about maybe turning that around.
Yeah.
So things are changing.
Some of them may have even been, like, partially, like, well, I wouldn't call it sabotaged, but during the decommissioning process, instead of keeping them in a state where they can easily be restarted, there have been efforts to make that a lot more challenging and time consuming and costly so that they can point at that as a reason why it can't be done. And it is very disappointing. Like, but watching Japan's gung-ho to get those reactors back online because importing gas has been killing them. Like,
and that's
they
another,
cannot
like,
afford to keep doing that.
Right.
Like, luckily,
they have
the gas
inflation.
Market is kind of low right now, so they got a little bit of a reprieve. But yeah, when you're reliant on that and you've got an aging population and a fairly cold climate, like that's not a good recipe.
And even in the situation where you've got the scarce energy, you've kind of mentioned it before when you like some of your reactors are down for refurbishments and things, it's like there's almost this balancing mechanism, this negative one from the state or from regulators where it's like if the reactors try running at full capacity, that's a problem. They have to shut down every so often. They do all of these refurbishments that, you know, coincidentally and conveniently, the only person or the only company that can do those refurbishments is friends with the lawmakers in the area and friends with the gas companies in the area. So, but they have to come in and you have to pay them millions of dollars to do all these upgrades that, you know, aren't necessarily required. It's just everything's an attack, it almost feels like. It's hard not to feel paranoid that everything's an attack.
Yeah, it's like we're lucky in Ontario. Our IESO board has pretty good influence over energy policy, and their opinions are taken seriously when they tell our policymakers that we need to ensure reliability at all costs. Like that should be number one on everyone's list. Like I have no problem with clean being on people's priority list, but it should never be ahead of reliability. And like even affordability should be next on that list before we start thinking about it being clean, because like people don't care as much about their source of energy when they're in poverty and they're just struggling to get by. If they will take whatever they can get. Like there's still millions, billions of people around the world that burn shit to sustain themselves, and like they burn this stuff in their homes and it creates particulates that poisons their families. Like just upgrading them to having a coal plant that's offsite so they can have electricity in the home, that changes significantly the lives of millions of people. So like it is unfair for us to say it and like push our Western ideals on these developing nations that they have to skip over what we did that was so successful. Like I would love to see them skip right over and go to nuclear power, but like people are going to do whatever they want. And once they've actually developed some form of wealth and lowered their time preference, then they start to give a shit about the environment. Then they start wanting to build the technology that can reduce their carbon footprint. And then we can start actually like thinking seriously about that. But when we got billions of people lift out of poverty, like I think that should be priority number one, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, you made me think of something back there. How this load of the Bitcoin network will be on these nuclear power plants. It seems like Bitcoin will bring the reason to have a nuclear age.
I certainly hope so.
As well as compute for AI, I would think. You need so much energy for those two industries. Never want, there's such consumers of energy. So they need a big amounts, and they will flock to the ones that can offer them the most.
Yeah, that was literally my next question, or my next observation was, we mentioned some of these partnerships in Pennsylvania and in Georgia, and I think Terra Wolf, and you mentioned a few others. Do you know how
those
are going?
Don't forget the one in
Abu Dhabi. Yeah. Are those working? Are the utilities and the power plants seeing benefit from it? Is it enough? Do we just need more customers? We need more compute centers and more Bitcoin mining centers, or are we starting to see positive movement from that?
It does sound like it from like all the podcasts that I listen to and the people like the ERCOT managers and the managers of like the ISOs in Georgia and like I think Ohio is part of the MISO grid, but from what I understand, like they are seeing it very positively when they actually see it in action. Like if it's all theoretical to them, like a lot of these engineers and whatnot, they can come off as it's too good to be true, so that it does take some convincing in some cases until they actually see it in action and you provide them real data from it really happening. Like seeing a load curtail in real time in sync with the grid demand is not something that they're really used to. It's such a profound change in how the grid gets managed. Like it's going to take a significant time for them to like update to the paradigm shift. But like, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of like the modeling that they're doing that doesn't incorporate a load as flexible as Bitcoin mining is outdated and obsolete already just because of the existence of Bitcoin mining and the type of load that it provides. Like there's a lot of interest in loads that can be flexible to varying degrees. Like they want to do hydrogen production, synthetic chemicals, desalination. Like a lot of these are going to be able to curtail at times of high grid stress, but the profile for like the capital structures for building like hydrogen electrolyzers, they thrive on high capacity factors. Like they will not be economic at low capacity factors, especially if you have high transportation and storage constraints. Like if you can use it on site, you're going to have a lot better like economics for sure. Like if you have an industry or some sort of source that's using it as fuel. But
that reminds back to what Mike was kind of alluding to, is like they have all this energy requirement. So these compute, these AI data centers, but these Bitcoin miners, it's easier for them to attract capital. Like, people are willing to invest in OpenAI and Riot and CleanSpark with, you know, to take dilution of shares and to just keep loaning them money, keep investing seed rounds. It's not the case for that. If you're trying to get a nuclear reactor built, finding investment, finding people who are willing to commit to the decades long, you know, investment essentially requirement before you ever even think about seeing returns, right? It's not easy. But some of these power hungry industries that are, they're letting the nuclear reactors, the utilities, kind of transfer that risk to these companies who are, they need so much money to stay alive, but they have so much hyper growth potential that they raise that capital, but they're funneling it through their energy use to these industries like nuclear energy, which have been struggling to find funding, struggling to find revenue. And it's like the market's starting to figure it out. And this is starting to be a solution that's like, we don't need your subsidies anymore. We can do this just out of the most efficient use of energy and technology. And I'm wondering like what the cap on this is. It seems like the potential is so high here. We could just keep going with this and it could keep growing.
Once we've built the facilities that can pump out like fully assembled nuclear reactors that can be deployed quickly, like at the same rate that we build like aircraft and shipping freighters, like then we're in a whole different paradigm. But yeah, getting there is going to be challenging because there's a lot of chicken and egg scenarios, getting supply chains, getting all the fuel sorted out, because a lot of the fuel resources were coming from Russia. So that needs to be reconfigured. But there's like billions of dollars of pledges that are being directed at reinvigorating the American, European fuel enrichment capabilities. Like Canada's been talking about expanding some of our mines. It's just given a lot more confidence because we're getting the right signals from the policymakers. They're showing a lot more interest. They're taking nuclear power investments out of like sin stock categories where they would be exposed to high costs of capital. And now they're being considered in these green energy bonds where they can be more competitive with other technologies like wind and solar. Like even if they're not eligible for all of the same tax credits, it's just, it starts to even the playing field a little bit more. Like as much as I would love to see just the subsidies done away with altogether, like at least a little bit more balance is nice to see if they're going to be spending our money in ways that are not directed by us as individuals. I'd like to see, yeah, the technologies have a better chance to compete on their merits rather than just who can spin a better narrative to get a better seat at the political trough. And it seems that, yeah, the wind and solar people have been telling a very good story and spinning a good narrative for the last little while, but reality is starting to sink in, and it's not coming to fruition as it was promised. And now they're starting to act like a toddler that has a new baby in the home. I get the attention that nuclear is getting these days. And it is comical to see some of the fits that some of these people that despise nuclear power are having when they see investments coming towards the sector, because they see it as capital that's not being directed towards their sector. They have this very Malthusian, like zero-sum game type of idea of how energy systems are supposed to work. But advocating in the energy sector is a very weird space these days, because there's so many voices shouting at each other and just trying to get the attention of the people with the money. But I'm thinking like this AI stuff with the computing load, flexible computing loads, that's just giving the confidence that they need, that they will have the demand that's needed when the technology is matured enough to go commercial. Because that's one of the puzzle pieces, is like that they have trouble building like large power infrastructure in places where it's far away from the consumers. Like there's been proposals to build hydroelectric dams like all throughout like northern Canada, but they always end up falling flat, just citing uncertain demand growth as the reason why they can't put the capital into it, because
you're only going to get 40-50% capacity out of it. There's no desire to build the thing in the first place. So like, and then now we see things like what Gridless is doing all around Africa. They'll find all these opportunities where they're not fully utilizing like a small hydro facility and plugging it up. And we can apply that model anywhere in the world with existing infrastructure that's not being fully utilized. And then we can use that as an anchor to deploy new capital energy assets without that risk. That risk just completely goes away. Like, yeah, maybe you project demand growth for like a community to grow at X percent per year, but then it doesn't grow into fruition. Like you now have a load like Bitcoin mining that you can either add more, you can take it off. Like all you call up Steve Barber at Upstream Data, you tell him what your power profile looks like, and he'll build you a custom hash hut and give you the new synchronizing software that they have and just let her rip. Like it's, by the time these SMRs are ready, like the mining syncing with the grid technology is going to be so advanced and so mature that it's going to be a no-brainer. Anybody that's not doing this is going to be left in the dust. Like
Steve Barber will build you a hash up, but he won't put in a good word for nuclear energy on Energy Podcast, will he?
Oh, I know. He likes doing his hydrocarbons, and I don't blame him. They're great for all kinds of things.
Everybody's got to talk their book.
He definitely is interested in going upstream when nuclear is ready to knock on his door. Could be a few years, though.
I have to ask, how close are we to that vision of little nuclear huts powering cities? Like, what's the term for it, Dan? What was that?
Yeah, it was the small modular reactors. That was like let's talk about these these alternative like thorium. You got these SMRs, you've got these new era or these new generation types of reactors and technology. What's the latest on that front? Like are we building those? Are people building those? Is it solving problems? Is it kind of getting us closer to kind of this basically what Mike said, like this flourishing?
Yeah, it's we're still in the gradually phase. There's relationships are being built, all of the groundwork is being placed, and there's a lot of research going on for different fuel configurations and enrichment types and coolant types. So the new generation of reactors is going to be more than just the typical boiled water reactors. Like there's a few other reactor types that they're not in as common use, like molten salt reactors. I think like the Russians and French have one or two of those.
What are the differences there? What are the differences of the constraints or the benefits compared to,
like the boiled water reactor? Yeah. The boiled water reactors, it's basically your output temperatures are limited to about not even 400 degrees Celsius. So it can only apply to on the heat side, it can only apply to so many different markets. Like they use reactors for district heating as well as doing electricity. But yeah, typically they're going to be generating electricity by generating steam. And the way that they do that is the fuel has the chain reaction with when the neutron collides with the uranium nucleus, and then they capture a few of those and let the rest collide. And then we capture that energy in various different mediums. So traditionally it's water. In the CANDU fleet, it's heavy water. And there's reactors that use high temperature gas. Like they can use helium, or I think argon can also possibly used as a gas. As long as it's inert and doesn't cause any reactivity or corrosion, it can be used in that for transferring heat. There's the molten salt ones that are going to use like a high temperature salt fluid slurry where the fuel is actually like dissolved into part of that coolant. And then it uses a multi-stage heat exchanger loop to transfer that into a water loop that then converts steam. It's basically all just different fancy ways to capture the heat, transfer it to a steam turbine, and either use that steam for process heat for industries or district heating,
the heat
or generate
from nuclear
electricity
reaction, right?
Yeah, a ton of energy when those neutrons collide with the uranium nucleus.
And then, like, we're not even getting the full capacity of these things. Like, you had mentioned thorium, and that's a whole different pathway, because thorium, while it exists in abundance, it's not naturally fissile. It needs to be bred into a fertile state. So once it's been exposed to a neutron environment, it transmutes into uranium-233, which is then fissile. So when it can continue the chain reaction. So it breeds its own fuel. And then some of the other ones, like there's plutonium byproducts that can then continue cascading chain reactions. So there's mixed oxide fuels that will have more than uranium. They'll have like oxides of all of they call them the transuranics. It's basically, if you look at a periodic table, it's the strip at the very bottom where the actinides are, where you find uranium, plutonium, neptunium, and cesium. There's a bunch of, or not, cesium's not there, but all of the different high, heavy elements that will cause fission when they get exposed to the correct environment. And then we do other things too, like we expose various other elements that can be packed into fuel rods and put into these reactors. And then when they're exposed to these environments, we can literally create rare isotopes that we then use in medical treatments.
Yeah. Okay. Let's stop there, because I kind of want to focus on this next question before you get too far into that. So in Bitcoin mining, right, like we're finding all of these second order effects that miners are able to provide benefit, right? So they're helping to reduce methane flaring. They are monetizing stranded energy. They are driving down, in some cases, greenhouse gas emissions. They're providing this extra heat that can be recycled and used for other purposes. And they're just finding all these efficiencies, and it's like these little downstream effects. Not all of them you could build a business out of yet, but it's like, it's more subsidy. It's more of your bills and your cost and your, and there's just more benefit that it provides outside of that system. And it sounds like there's, you know, my question was gonna be, what are the second order effects of nuclear energy, of these nuclear reactors? You talk about these isotopes that we're able to isolate and use in medicine, but there's, you know, what other benefits? And then also, we've kind of glossed over it, but what are some of the outputs that are like nuclear waste that we have to deal with, you know, once we're done using those rods to generate electricity?
Yeah, well, nuclear, like when it's applied to the right markets, it's going to be very beneficial. Just the electricity and the heat, when if it's competitive in the market that it's applied to, like some of these reactors, like the new, like the prototype, the very, very small SMRs, because nuclear power is traditionally relied on scale to make up for the economics. So now this new generation of SMRs, we want to try to do more multiples to drive down costs of production per each individual unit, which requires significant commitments of a lot of customers to buy into this before you can commit to really investing the capital in doing something like this. But like, these reactors will be competitive in markets like in Northern Canada, where importing diesel has very narrow windows and it's incredibly expensive for those local communities. So that's where this technology is going to start to have a real, real benefit, because it's going to open up a lot more markets that weren't available to nuclear power before, especially on the heat side, because some of these other coolants, I had said that the boiled water reactors can only apply to about 300-400 degrees Celsius. We are experimenting with coolants now that will be able to have output temperatures closer to like 1,000 degrees Celsius, which can be used and applied to a lot of industries and displace their hydrocarbon use, whether it's for their heat or the steam. And I don't foresee a future where we completely displace all of our hydrocarbon usage. Like, we use it in too many things, but if we can displace it a lot from our energy and our heat needs for our various industries, like, we can have a significant impact on like the environment and the amount of pollution that people do get exposed to. Because like, although we have much better technology for capturing the outputs from hydrocarbons, like, it's still not perfect. But then like, nuclear has its trade-offs as well. You would mention the waste. Like, waste is also like a sticking thing, because it means,
that's one of the big FUD points, right?
Yeah. Because it also means multiple things. Like, by waste, are you like the spent fuel that still has more energy in it and rare isotopes that could be extracted under the right circumstances?
like the tritium. It is a nuisance when it's not concentrated, but a slideshow that I had seen at a conference I was at showed that if it can be concentrated to the right purity, it is a very valuable commodity in the fusion research sector. Then you can get a lot of dollars per gram of that very heavy water. And then what else? And then there's just like general PPE, like low level waste, like stuff that people were wearing, or like buildings that were torn down that have very, very small amounts of radiation that they were exposed to, that has a large volume, but it's significantly low hazard. So yeah, the trickiest one to manage obviously is the spent fuel, because once uranium has been exposed to a neutron environment, it transmutes into all kinds of different interesting isotopes that release a lot different profiles of radiation. And some of them will decay faster than others. And those are the far more hazardous ones. The ones that decay and burn off and disappear to a safer state are the dangerous ones. There are others that exist for a long time, but the reason that they last a long time is that they're decaying at a very slow rate, which means that they're not as hazardous if you're exposed to them. Like, unless you are eating this stuff, your risk of being negatively impacted by them is negligible. Yeah, we have means to store it, and even just like, I've got there's a canister that they store them in on site for, and they can keep those indefinitely for decades before they get moved into a different storage location.
And there's all kinds of development and research and discovery that there could be more use out of this stuff in the future. We could get more energy out of them. We could discover new isotopes. There could be value in some of these. We're not just burying them underground for thousands of years or hundreds of years or whatever. Necessarily.
Near where I grew up, there were silver mines. But one of the byproducts of silver mining, there was cobalt in it. And that cobalt was a nuisance that they didn't want at the time, like, because it was like 120 years ago. But now they're going back and looking at that as a potential source of cobalt, considering that we have a very high demand for that material in our high-tech society. So you never know, like hundreds of years from now, like humanity may find a use for anything and everything. Like we do a pretty damn good job of taking all of the waste byproducts from coal and from gas and oil and turn that into valuable products that we use every day. Like I can look around my room and almost everything I look at is some element of hydrocarbon associated with it. It's impossible to escape. Like we found a way to use the waste to make our lives better and keep the
more
economical.
I think that the moral of the story, or the takeaway here, is that a lot of our problems, a lot of society's like really big macro problems, they're solvable. We have the tools, we have the technologies, we have the science, we have the manufacturing and the at scale ability to solve these problems and to really improve the world generally. Bitcoin and nuclear are two of the foundational or key components that we could use to solve these problems, right? So it's not a matter of the funds or the technology. It's a matter of will. It doesn't seem like we have the will. And it goes back to something Mike said, or he says it all the time. He talks about stuff being peak fiat. Talk about like this. Everybody's trying to be close to the cantillionaire, the money printer. You know, these industries going for subsidies and the politicians going for money from lobbyists, so they impose harsh restrictions on the nuclear energy industry, and it's hard to compete in this peak fiat environment until you have these energy, this proof of work solution like Bitcoin mining that kind of solves it, fixes this, and Bitcoin fixes nuclear energy.
I certainly hope so, because peak fiat, you can see it definitely in the energy sector, the way that these subsidies get thrown around. Like
some of the stories that you hear about how, because the technology is getting more efficient, like windmills are getting better and solar panels are getting better, but that is causing people to throw them out before their useful life has been operated, because that resets the subsidy clock in some ways. And it's either that, or you've got a field full of windmills that aren't collecting subsidies anymore. That's when they transfer ownership to a local landowner who's now on the hook for maintenance and operation. And without those tax subsidies, they don't have the same incentive to be operating, because the way that the production tax credit works is they have to be generating and selling power into the grid in order to be eligible for that credit. So that it creates just this weird dynamic where the least efficient energy is being like, is the first on the stack to get tapped into, but they and can at times drive the prices negative and they can still be profitable. And then you've got all your, everybody else on that grid that's just selling electricity is just getting, yeah, they're getting boned by it pretty hard.
Right. It's, you're going to end up with like windmill slumlords. You're going to have like these windmills all over these farms. Like if you drive across Iowa, which I do relatively often, this is like the windmills are everywhere. It's like, some people don't like it. They think it's like pollution, like site pollution or whatever. It kills birds.
It is ugly.
It can be a problem.
I'll give you
but
that.
Yeah. I wouldn't want one in my, I wouldn't want like one of these farms in my community. I'll be honest with you.
But there's people that want to fill Lake Ontario with these things.
And it's, yeah. And so back to my point here is, when these things are brand new and working great, white, shiny, just spinning in the wind, they're still ugly. What happens when they start getting rusty and old and people aren't using them anymore? It's just going to look, it's going to look dystopian, just so ugly. And it's like, just tearing them down and recycling them is too expensive. And it's full of these chemicals and these precious metals or whatever. Like, they can't just let that stuff into the mostly, you know, farmland. The breadbasket, the heartland of America, is full of these windmills that if they just start to decay, it's going to just ruin the soil. Or you want to put them in Ontario, or you want to put them in the ocean, and this stuff gets in the water. I mean, this, no, I don't think anybody thought this through.
Oh, and it's impressively catastrophic. Like, when they go down, it's quite the show. And like, I'm sure you guys are familiar with, and your audience have seen some of the images of the Blade graveyards, where it's just acres and acres of these things just buried in the ground, and then you see this teeny tiny bulldozer beside it all, and it's that's going to be the legacy of this generation. Is like, yeah, picture that 20 years from now, all of these decayed infrastructure that nobody has the impetus to maintain or actually like do anything with. Like, there was a discussion that I was a part of that was talking about that kind of idea, that the cost to recycle solar panels is 20 times the cost to just landfill them. And one argument that like that I can make about that, like talking about nuclear waste does decay over time. It becomes safer over time. The chemicals and heavy metals that are in the solar panels and some of these like windmills and the magnets that they use, they're forever chemicals. Once they leach into the environment, like they're pretty much permanently. So it's, and they're going to be a massive volume of these things. And I don't know what the next generation is going to think, but I don't think they're going to be impressed, especially when we finally get to the suddenly part of deploying nuclear anywhere and everywhere. They're going to look back and be like, why did we do that when we could have been doing this?
You're right, man. Before we start to wrap this up, one thing we never even got, which we get from everybody, is your Bitcoin story. So like, you've been working in the nuclear energy industry for a while, but at what point did you discover Bitcoin, and what was your rabbit hole experience like? Was it quick, or was it, you know, it takes some time?
Like everybody, I've got a few touch points early on, the cheering on Ron Paul and the Fed and a lot of the content I was taking in. Yeah, Max Kaiser popped up here and there. Considered mining in 2011, never did. And then cashed out of a poker site 17-18, forgot about it. And then when things went wild in the run-up at the end of 2020, early 21, then I started to
take it a little more seriously. I tried my hand at trading and learned very quickly that that's a good way to get burned. But then I just went down the podcast really quick and Max Kaiser, because that was familiar. I went right off the deep end into his podcast. And then you're hearing about this sailor guy, and the safety guy. And then before you know it, you've got a whole fucking rack of books. Like when I got back here, you're buying things like this fucking thing, this huge software thesis. Like that was an interesting read. I will say about that. But I started going down the podcasts, and then very shortly, about maybe 2 or 3 months in, I heard both Steve Barber and Adam Ohl talking about what Upstream Data is doing. And I got really interested in the energy side of this thing. And I hadn't really fully pieced that idea together of putting it with nuclear. And like full credit to my wife, who was the one that incepted the idea into my mind. It was the back end of the Elon Musk saga. So he talked it up on the front end, and then on the back end, he shat on the energy usage. And she just randomly throws up this idea of just like, well, why don't we just do it with nuclear power if we're building SMRs and whatnot? And she assumed that that was just a given thing that was already pretty out there. And I just kind of got obsessed with it. It just like this, the idea just kept branching out into different ways that it can expand and benefit the industry and benefit the people that this electricity is going to touch. Like we've already got plans to deploy the electricity. I am quite confident that applying something like Bitcoin mining to it will significantly amplify it. And then within like less than a year later, there was a contest that was put on by the North American Young Generation in Nuclear, which is an advocacy group that I'm a part of that's kind of in the industry. It was called Innovations for Nuclear, about how the nuclear power can be applied to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And like the goals at face value are good goals to aspire to achieving and resolving. So I threw in the idea of just like, SMRs are going to apply to all of those goals, and we can amplify it so that they can do it better, do it more cost effectively, and expand faster, expand bigger, because we can, without that stranded power aspect and without the risk of having to curtail a load, we can deploy bigger scenarios. Like if you were going to build like 15 megawatts for a community that's 10 megawatts and you expect them to grow into that in like 5-10 years, maybe we can consider building 25 megawatts because we know we have the placeholder that can sit there and consume that power and monetize it regardless of what the local community looks like. And we can configure it like from what it looks like in infinite amount of ways between different generations of ASICs with different efficiencies. We can play around with underclocking and overclocking. It's the tinkering and like the garage, like the engineers that are playing around with this technology and building things that are going to mature through the next cycles are going to catch a lot of people off guard. And it's going to be very, very, very exciting as we start seeing this integrate more into the power systems, like we're seeing, like they're starting to take it somewhat seriously, and definitely having the institutional cover of an ETF makes discussing this topic a lot easier, because you can dissuade the but it's only used by criminals argument very quickly when you just be like, well, what about Larry Fink? He likes it. Like, I don't know. I thought people in the nuclear sector would like to kind of follow around what these big investors are doing, because we would like to attract some of their capital, in fact. And if we can start expanding these ideas, like, now that people own Bitcoin, the asset, then they start thinking about how do we secure Bitcoin, the asset? And then they're like, oh, we can invest in mining too. And then it starts coming full circle.
And this, you bring this up a good point, like in attracting capital. Something I mentioned, like I don't, this isn't investment advice. I don't push anything other than Bitcoin on this show, but full disclosure, my biggest investment outside of Bitcoin is uranium. And it's been doing fantastic. Like the market is really growing. They have their own ETF. That's a couple ETFs that have come out that have been pretty new. Much smaller industry, much less liquid. And I mean, until recently, their spot market for uranium, like it didn't even have trades every day. Like people don't trade on it. The reactors, the utilities, they don't even necessarily buy uranium off of the spot market. They just have contracts with producers. But you know, part of the fun of the bull market, when you see this price discovery, you see Bitcoin going up, and it's just kind of this confirmation via price discovery that you were right. And it's happening in uranium too. And it's happening in sentiment around Bitcoin. It's happening in sentiment around nuclear energy. It's just a big turning point. And it's really encouraging to see this, especially happening at the same time. So I'm enjoying it, I'm sure, and I hope you're enjoying it.
How do you buy uranium, Dan? How do you do it?
You have to
buy the stock of uranium.
There's
like an ETF, like.
Yeah, there's ETF. There's companies. There's producers. Okay. There's miners. There is. There's a new fund that just buys.
There's refiners and they store it. There's a lot of ways. Companies that enrich it. Like, yeah, you can get like Areva, Urenco.
So there's lots of them. Denison.
Okay. Yeah, there's a handful in the uranium market. And it's starting to get a lot more exciting these days. Like Cameco, I've heard, is talking about expanding their operations. Like they had shut down some of their operations after Japan, because that was the market got flooded by Japan's fuel that they didn't need anymore, and demand just dropped like a rock. And now things have completely reinvigorated. Like Japan is so gung-ho to get those reactors back on, they invested billions of dollars in turning them into fortresses with like floating platforms for their backup generators. Like they're ready to keep out Godzilla, let alone a tsunami.
Yeah, I think from 2014 until the end of 2020, the price of uranium got as low as the teens. And I don't think you can produce uranium profitably until it's over $50 a pound. So for years, it was not profitable to produce uranium.
Just enough to service the existing fleet, but not, yeah.
So miners didn't. And there's been a shortage, and the price has spiked considerably. I think it's like close to $100 a pound now. But
you need that signal, that triggers exploration, because apparently like there's a lot of uranium that we have not even touched here in Canada. We have some of the best ore bodies on the planet. We didn't even get into like Australia. Like they're a total basket case with nuclear power these days. Like they hate it irrationally. Like trying to get
they're
into
crazy.
Like their advocacy environment, it's an interesting one. But I don't know, some nations are gonna go this path. Like I'd love to see things like nations like Madeira start getting into nuclear.
I mean, theoretically, right? Like theoretically, you could just put a reactor on the back of a truck and drive it out to some site where you can build a factory near the resources and just power that for years.
This is like fucking StarCraft that I used to play. This is what this feels like.
The Russians already do that with barges. They'll put a nuclear reactor on a ship and they'll just park it in a port, power a city.
We have nuclear submarines.
Yeah, like there's no reason that we couldn't be doing this a lot more, but it's just the fear has got into people's psyche, and it's just been hard to overcome. And it's going to be like that
for sure.
The idea that science progresses one funeral at a time. Just you got to wait for the generation that has these sentiments, because they're the ones in charge of policy predominantly right now. They're the ones with all the capital and the influence. So it seems that the next generation is very, very hungry for a technology like nuclear power to power their futures. And I have not seen any other spaces like Bitcoin other than nuclear as far as like the excitement and enthusiasm for the future. Like everyone else is just so goddamn depressing to be around.
Right. I mean, we've created a ton of technical debt and just inefficiencies through our management of the currency. We have to unwind that. We have to work our way through it, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. But dude, this was a great conversation. I do want, before you tell people where to send them to find you or to contact you, I do want maybe you to give some advice on if somebody's interested in this stuff and nuclear energy in general. It is a complex subject. It's a deep rabbit hole. Where do you recommend they start? Where would they dip their toe? Especially if you're not like an engineering background or like a physics background, like where would you kind of dip your toe in to start learning about this stuff?
If you like listening to podcasts, I recommend the Decoupled podcast hosted by Chris Kiefer. He does amazing advocacy for the sector. Even though he's a medical doctor, he got interested in nuclear by way of medical isotopes. And now he's one of Canada's premier advocacy groups at the head of it. And he's actually been influencing policy and getting the documents that they've been writing in front of our leaders. And then shortly thereafter, they'll announce policy changes favorable to nuclear power. So that is, they are very good on exploring a lot of topics surrounding nuclear power. They had a really good expose about the Vogtle reactor and why that was so costly and overrun on the time constraints, because just a lot of regulatory reasons, first of a kind problems. So they do get pretty deep and good into these topics. And then for if you just like read and exploring on your own, the World Nuclear Association has an amazing library of just all kinds of different rabbit holes you can explore regarding nuclear power. So like those are two things that I like to refer people to. There's a few other like good ones, like just power in general. I like Robert Bryce's podcast, The Power Hungry, is really good because he talks a lot about the transmission infrastructure and how important that is, and that because that's one of the constraints that they're finding a lot with building wind and solar at further and further away from their customers, is they're running into a lot more transmission constraints and transmission costs. Like, it's great that it's free when it's being generated, but it still costs a lot of capital resources to deliver it. So he explores like a lot of things like that. And just as for myself, I'm on X, the Nuclear Bitcoiner, also on Noster, Orange Pill app. I should be using those more than I do, but all of the action is on X. But like, yeah, there's good Bitcoin content on Noster, but all the nuclear people are on X, and I would like to see them start getting over there, especially some of the influencers, and get them a taste of those zaps and start seeing
yeah
more,
what's the
more, sure. more at Noster nuclear space.
I can't remember the guy's name now, so I won't even bring it up. But yeah, so we'll have your Noster NPub in the show notes, along with your Twitter handle.
I can list that off letter by letter if you like.
Oh, yeah. Spare us. But I also do want to reiterate that I think if you enjoyed this conversation, you should go check out why Bitcoin with Sly Goomba, and their conversation was great. And we found out, go listen to your conversation with Peter McCormick on what Bitcoin did. You were interviewed by Safe, quite a few others, right? So if you want to...
Oh, there's a pile of them. Yeah, I like the one I did with Cedric, Bitcoin Matrix. That was a good one. A good conversation with John Vallis. Yeah. Got a few more interesting ones lined up. We'll see. Yeah, Walker wants to talk nuclear, so I'll do another fucking Bitcoin God podcast.
There you go. So if you want to know more, you want to hear more from Nuclear Bitcoiner, there's plenty of resources out there. I suggest you check those out. I think nuclear industry is super fascinating. I think if this sounds interesting to you, you should definitely take that jump into that rabbit hole.
Absolutely. I agree.
It's been a great conversation. I'm super, opened my eyes about an industry I really knew nothing about. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. I love talking about this stuff, and especially with people that the Bitcoin part is already established. I don't need to explain to you how Bitcoin works, because that I find, explaining nuclear to Bitcoin people is far easier than explaining Bitcoin to nuclear people, especially if they've been exposed to Keynesian economics in school, because, you get the usual myths that are propagated in that worldview, but it is what it is. They'll come around as they start seeing it in action, but I'm gonna keep beating this drum and until I don't need to anymore, until the world just sees this as just a general common sense thing that we're just doing because it's the best way to use our energy. And like one more crazy thing, like I foresee a future where Bitcoin mining is using roughly the amount of power that all of humanity is using today, but at that time, it's still only going to be a fraction of a percent of all the energy that humanity is producing. Like that's the future that I'm envisioning.
Energy consumption is highly correlated to quality of life and innovation and growth and everything like that. So I agree with you there. Although I want to say, I do think that nuclear can help bring in hyper-Bitcoinization. But I'm wondering, do you have a word in this in nuclear? Because I don't know if hyper-nuclearization sounds as catchy or is maybe it sounds a little scary. But do you have like a big yellow world?
They've been throwing around the nuclear renaissance as the
the catchy phrase.
Okay. But I like that one.
Yeah, like, but then there's hesitancy because we don't want to get ahead of ourselves because early 2010 was the nuclear renaissance was supposed to happen then, and then we got derailed by misfortune.
Maybe we'll call it the atomic awakening.
Ooh, I do like that. I like that. I like that a lot. On that note,
we gotta stop talking, or we will keep talking.
Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked 80 IQ plebs, reach out to us at hello@highhashrate.com. Or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!